Rusty Quill presents The Magnus Archives. Episode 2. Do Not Open.
Statement of Joshua Gillespie regarding his time in possession of an apparently empty wooden casket. Original statement given November 22nd, 1998. Audio recording by Jonathan Sims, head archivist of the Magnus Institute, London. Statement begins. It started when I was in Amsterdam for a holiday with a few of my friends. Everything you're thinking right now, you're right. We were all early 20s, just graduated, and decided to spend a couple of weeks going crazy on the continent, so you can almost certainly fill in all the blanks yourself. There were very few points where I'd say that I was entirely sober, and even fewer where I acted like it, though I wasn't quite as bad as some of my friends who had a hard time handling themselves at times. This may have been why I headed out alone that morning. No idea of the exact date, but it was sometime in mid-May. The others were sleeping off their assorted hangovers, and I decided to head out into the beautiful sunshine of that Netherlands morning and take a walk. Before graduating from Cardiff with the others, I had been studying architecture, so was looking forward to spending a few hours by myself to wander and really take in the buildings of central Amsterdam. I was not disappointed. It's a beautiful city. But I realized too late that I hadn't taken any map or guidebook with me, and an hour or two later I was thoroughly lost. I wasn't particularly worried, as it was still mid-afternoon at this point, and getting lost in the back streets had kind of been what I was trying to do. But I still decided I'd better make an actual effort to find my way back to where my friends and I were staying off Ellenstraat. I managed it eventually, but my inability to speak Dutch meant I spent a good hour riding the wrong way on the various trams. By the time I got back to Ellenstraat, it was starting to get dark, and I was feeling quite stressed, so I decided to pop into one of the cafes to relax before joining up with my friends. I couldn't say for sure exactly how long I was in there, but I do know it had gotten fully dark by the time I noticed I wasn't sat at my table alone. I've tried to describe the man who now sat opposite me many times, but it's difficult. He was short, very short, and felt like he had an odd density to him. His hair was brownish, I think, cut quite short, and he was clean-shaven. His face and dress were utterly unremarkable, and the more I try to think of exactly what he looked like, the harder it is to picture him clearly. To be honest, though, I'm inclined to blame that on the drugs. The man introduced himself as John, and asked how I was. I replied as best I could, and he nodded, saying he was also an Englishman inside a foreign land. I remember he used that exact phrase because it struck me at the time as very odd. He said he was from Liverpool, though I don't recall him having any sort of accent, and that he was looking for a friend who he could rely on for a favour. Now, high as I was, I got suspicious as soon as he said that last part, and I started to shake my head. John said it was nothing too onerous, just looking after a package for him until he had some friends pick it up, and that he would pay well. I thought he was talking about smuggling, and was about to refuse again when he reached into his jacket, I think, and pulled out an envelope. Inside was £10,000. I know, I counted it. I knew it was a stupid move, but I kept remembering my friend Richard telling me how easy it had been to get a pound of hash through customs on his first trip to Holland, and holding that much cash in my hands, I said yes. John smiled, thanked me, and said that he would be in touch. He left the coffee shop, and I immediately started panicking about what I had agreed to. I wanted to chase after him and return the money, but Something weighed me down, kept me locked into my seat. I just sat there for a long time. I don't remember much about the next few days except worrying about when I'd see John again. I was careful not to spend any of the money he'd given me, and had decided to return it as soon as he turned up. I'd say I had made a mistake and couldn't take his money, or look after anything from him. I tried to enjoy myself, but it was like this shadow hanging over me, and I couldn't stop thinking about it. I waited for days, right up until the end of our trip, but he never showed up. I obsessively checked my suitcase before boarding the plane home, just in case someone had snuck something into it, but there was nothing new in there. I flew back to England with my friends still high and £10,000 tucked into my coat pocket. It was surreal. It wasn't until almost a year later that I felt confident enough to actually spend any of the money. I'd moved down to work for a small architect's firm in Bournemouth, on the south coast. It was an entry-level job and the pay wasn't great, but it was the only offer I got in my chosen field, so I moved down there with the hopes of getting some experience and a better position in a year or two. Bournemouth was a decent-sized seaside town, though much less idyllic than I'd assumed it would have been. But rents for a place of my own were a little bit out of my price range, given my starting pay grade. I didn't know anyone else down there and wasn't keen to share my space with strangers, so I decided to use some of the money I'd been given in Amsterdam the previous year. I reasoned they were unlikely to find me at this stage. I'd not given John any of my details when he spoke to me, not even my name. And if they hadn't been able to find me over the course of the last year, it was doubtful they'd be able to track me here. Also, if it had been drug smuggling as I suspected, £10,000 probably wasn't so much money to them that they'd track me this far over it. Also, and looking back this sounds stupid, but I'd just grown a beard and thought it would be hard for anyone to recognize me as the same guy, so I spent a bit of John's money on renting a nice one-bedroom flat in the Triangle near the town centre and moved in almost immediately. About a week later, I was in my kitchen cutting up some fruit for breakfast, and I heard the doorbell ring. I answered it to see two red-faced delivery men. Between them, they carried an immense package, which they'd clearly had to manoeuvre up the narrow stairs of the building I lived in. They asked if I was Joshua Gillespie, and when I said yes, they said they had a delivery addressed to me, and pushed past into the hall. They didn't seem to be from any delivery company I knew, and they weren't wearing any uniforms. I tried to ask them some questions, but as soon as they'd placed the box on the floor, they turned around and walked out. They were both well over 6 feet tall and very imposing, so there was little I could have done to stop them leaving, even if I'd wanted to. The door slammed behind them, and I was left alone with this package. It was about 2 meters long, maybe 1 meter wide, and roughly the same deep. It was sealed with parcel tape, and written on the top was my name and address in thick, curving letters. But there was no return address or postmark of any sort. I was starting to risk being late for work at this point, but I decided I couldn't bring myself to leave without seeing what was inside, so I fetched the knife from my kitchen counter and cut the tape, keeping the box closed. Inside was a coffin. I don't know what I expected, but it wasn't that. My knife fell to the floor, and I just stared at it in mute surprise. It was made of unvarnished, pale yellow wood, and had a thick metal chain wrapped around it, which was closed at the top with a heavy iron padlock. The lock was closed, but had the key sitting inside it. I started to reach for it when I noticed two other things on the coffin lid. The first was a piece of paper, folded in half and tucked under the chain, which I took. The other was the presence of three words scratched deep into the wood of the casket in letters 3 inches high. They read, "Do not open." I withdrew my hand from the padlock slowly, unsure what I was supposed to do. At some point I must have sat down, as I found myself on the floor propped up against the wall, staring at this bizarre thing that had inexplicably turned up at my home. I remembered the piece of paper at this point and unfolded it, but it simply read, "Delivered with gratitude, J." Strange as it sounds, it was only then I made the connection with the man I'd met in Amsterdam. He'd told me he wanted someone to look after a package for a while. Was this the package he was talking about? Was I to be looking after a corpse? Who was coming to pick it up? When? I called in sick to work, and just sat there, watching the coffin for what might have been minutes or might have been hours. I just had no idea what to do. Eventually, I steeled myself and moved towards it, until my face was just inches away from the lid. I took a deep breath, trying to see if I could smell anything from inside. Nothing. If there was a dead body in there, it hadn't started to smell yet. Not that I really knew what a dead body smelled like. It was early summer at this point, which would mean that they must have died recently, if there was a body in there at all. As I got up, my hand brushed the wood of the coffin, and I realized it was warm, very warm, like it had been lying in the sun for hours. Something about it made my flesh crawl slightly, and I withdrew my hand quickly. I decided to make a cup of tea. It was something of a relief standing next to the kettle, as from that angle I couldn't see the thing out in the hall. I could just ignore it. I didn't move even after I'd filled my mug. I just stood there, sipping my tea, not even noticing it was still far too hot to drink comfortably. When I finally got the nerve to step back out into the hall, the coffin still lay there, unmoving. I finally made a decision and, firmly gripping the padlock, I removed the key and placed it on the hall table next to the door. I then took hold of the coffin and chain and started to pull it further into my flat. It was weird to touch it. The wood still had that unsettling warmth to it, but the chain was as cold as you'd expect from a thick piece of iron, and apparently hadn't taken on any of the heat. I didn't have any cupboards with enough space to hold the thing, so in the end I just dragged it into my living room and pushed it up against the wall, as out of the way as possible. I cut up the cardboard box it had been sealed in and put it with the rubbish outside. And just like that I had, apparently, started storing a coffin in my home. At the time, I think I assumed it was full of drugs, at least as far as I assumed anything about the situation. Why anyone would store something in such a noticeable way, or with a total stranger like me, these weren't questions I could even guess at an answer to. But I decided it was best to think about it as little as possible.